As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, I'm a journalist based out in Reykjavik, Iceland, where this week we've had some sun, the Euros contest has been on, and England went through against Germany. That was a big event, and for me, and lots of fun, and I've had lots of time to play games too. I've been on my new PS5 a lot. I've been playing a bit of Returnal, and I've been playing a lot of Ratchet and Clank. I also want to give a big shout out to a listener of the show, Hopple, who is in our Discord group. He was very kind and sent to me his old Xbox, because he has upgraded to one of the new ones. So I got an Xbox, I think, what's it called again? I get mixed up with these names, an Xbox One S. A digital console, and immediately signed up for Game Pass Ultimate. So I've been seeing what's on Game Pass, I've been having a lot of fun with that. I've been playing some Carrion, and I've dipped into a whole host of games there. I played a little bit of Elder Scrolls Online, I played a little bit of Call of the Sea. Carrion was my main one. I played right through to the end of that game. I've been having a lot of fun with it, and I will definitely be talking about it on a future episode. So I just want to say a big thank you to Hopple for sending me that Xbox. And I'll be talking about a lot more Xbox games on the show from now on, and Game Pass games. It seems like a really solid place for indie games. There's loads of good stuff there. And so I think I'll be using it as my screen-based indie game machine from now on, and covering games that come to the service. So if you're a Game Pass user and an Xbox user, you can expect more games that apply to you in future episodes. This episode, I'm going to keep the intro short, because we have a special episode this week. I finished Death Stranding recently after playing it over the course of about a year, with long breaks in between my kind of quite intensive sessions with it. And it's a very difficult game to describe. It's a game that has a lot going on in terms of plot. It's a game that has a lot going on in terms of mechanics and scenario and the artistic vision and the writing behind the whole thing. It's really a dizzying game to play, and an even more dizzying game to talk about. So I called in some reinforcements. So we have a special guest this week, Kieran Daly, the editor of Radical Art Review and a good gamer friend of mine. Kieran was on at the turn of the year to talk about his favourite games of 2020, and he picked Death Stranding as one of his absolute top games of the year. And so it seemed like now that I'd finally finished it, I could revisit the game with Kieran and have him help me untangle this crazy game. Our conversation ran quite long, I think because of the nature of the game, so I'm just going to start it off now. I'll be back next week with a regular episode talking about Returnal, talking more about Ratchet and Clank and all the other games that I've been playing. And just before the interview, I will mention that this show is listener-supported via Patreon, so if you enjoy this episode, if you're a new listener who enjoys what you hear, or a long-time listener who decided that now's the time to support Gaming in the Wild, you can do so for as little as a dollar, euro, or pound a month at patreon.com/gamingintheWild, where you'll get blog posts, game reviews, sale recommendations, and the occasional extra episode. I would like to say a big shout-out to all of my Patreon supporters, and a special thank you to Hopple for that Xbox console. I really appreciate it. And thank you very much to you if you're thinking of becoming a member. And with that said, let's move on to this special Death Stranding episode. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Okay, so today's podcast, I am joined by my friend and gaming mentor, the editor, or one of the editors of the Radical Art Review, the magnificent Mr. Kieran Daly. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, you make me sound like Yoda.
You are my gaming Yoda. I think last time you were on the show for the Games of the Year, we talked a little bit about how you're partially responsible for me playing games at all, because you showed me Journey.
Oh, yeah.
We were drunk.
That's true. I mean, I think, well, the game we're going to discuss was one of my Games of the Year in that podcast.
Yes, it was. So, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit and tell people who you are?
Okay, I'm Kieran. I'm not typically good at introducing myself, but I'm a journalist who lives in sunny Margate in the southeast of England. I've been playing games since I was about 5 years old. That's thousands of well-spent hours, in my opinion. I'm a tech journalist, and I run the Radical Art Review, which is a print magazine distributed across the UK, covering art, activism, and independent creators of all stripes.
Very nice. And what was your first game when you were five? Can you remember?
My first game when I was five was, my mum bought me a Game Boy Color for my fifth birthday. And I remember this day vividly because I got it before I went to school. And my first game was called Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine or something.
Wow.
And it was like I don't know if it was like a Metroidvania, like Indiana Jones thing, but I remember liking it. I don't know if it was good. Let me see.
You ever visited it again?
Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine. Yeah, I mean, it's 9 out of 10 on Steam still, so it can't have been that bad.
Sounds Castlevania-ish if you're walking around whipping stuff.
There's a lot of whipping, and you're in like Babylonian ruins. You've got to find sort of trinkets.
And what about more recently? What have you been playing lately? I know that you've had to take down your console setup because you're moving house, so you've been mostly on Switch, right? But what have you been playing?
Switch. I've been playing Mario Sunshine. Quite a lot, and I've been playing, some recommendations from you, I've been playing Narita Boy.
And how are you getting on with Narita Boy?
Narita Boy is good, actually, but it's kind of, I think it just almost doesn't hold your hand whatsoever. So a lot of the time, like, my playthroughs will be about an hour, and it will be me just trying to find out how to get to the next area. And by the time I work out how to do it, I've kind of done with my session, and then I wait till the next confusing room.
Yeah, it's like it's a Metroidvania, but it doesn't have a map. Metroidvanias without maps, it's like a strange genre. And I feel like Narita Boy is big enough that it has 3 or 4 different areas in one zone, kind of, but small enough that you don't really need a map because there's only 3 or 4 places to go. But it's big enough to make it feel a little confusing. So it's in a weird kind of in between zone of needing a map and not needing a map. Do you know what I mean?
I would like a map.
Yeah, I generally lean towards liking maps as well.
I think you're allowed. I think we're allowed maps.
We are allowed maps. But today we are going to talk about a game that you played, I think, maybe last year, right?
Yeah.
And I played this year and finished a couple weeks ago. It's a pretty big game. It's a pretty controversial game. It's a game with a lot going on and a lot to unpack. It is Hideo Kojima's Death Stranding, the post-apocalyptic delivery man Amazon game art movie. And I thought we could start off by trying to boil down what this game is. There's a lot going on in this game, but I always find it fun to try and boil games down into a soundbite, so I've got one prepared here. I'll go first. My overview of Death Stranding is that it's an impressively innovative but deeply flawed art movie of a game that asks the player to struggle through a difficult landscape and a more difficult story.
Yes. I think my summary is that Death Stranding is something new, not necessarily better, but new and different to things that have come before. and for that reason, it is commendable in some ways. And in other ways, it is deeply divisive and alienating.
Right. Right, but we're going to start off by talking about the core elements of the game, some of the gameplay, the scenario, the look and the sound of it. And we're going to start off by trying to be spoiler-free. So if you're a listener who hasn't played Death Stranding yet, you're going to be okay for this first section of the game, of the podcast, rather. And then we will be sure to do a big spoiler warning when we move on to talking about late-game stuff. And the gameplay is a spoiler in a way, because you start off with quite a basic setup in this game. And as you get more abilities and elements that come into the gameplay, it's part of the surprise is finding out what the things that you can do later on. So we're going to leave out some of that gameplay stuff and just talk about the start of the game, basically. And then we'll give you a big spoiler warning. So if you've played the game, we will talk about some late game stuff later on. But the scenario of this game is that you play as Sam Strand, played by Norman Reedus, who is a courier in a post-apocalyptic America where all the infrastructure has vanished, so there's no roads. Everyone lives in bunkers or cities, and travel is really, really hazardous. There are some nasty things out in the landscape. The landscape is very difficult. The rain is like acid rain that harms you, basically. And Sam gets a job of traveling across America, reconnecting this fractured society by plugging people into the chiral network, which is a kind of internet. And the basic gameplay of the game is that you schlep stacks of parcels, which can include like industrial supplies, medical supplies, food, machinery, and all of these things are just big boxes that stack up onto Sam's back in a huge stack, like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, that he has to then schlep across a difficult landscape. So the basic gameplay is that you travel between installations across a beautiful landscape. And what was your experience like when you first started the game in those opening hours?
As someone who used to work as like a Deliveroo, like fast food bike courier, it felt like I was just doing that job again, but in like a slightly less sweaty way.
A noble way, reconnecting America via the power of pizza.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I was immediately drawn to the sort of environment, and I thought the story actually started off as pretty compelling in its early stages. And obviously there was like Low Roar and JFDR came on, and I was like, okay, this seems cool. This is my kind of game. And then I don't know. I mean, I didn't struggle too much with the carrying stuff element of it. I don't know why that is. I think I just held down both analog sticks or something the entire time. So I didn't really. It was kind of like a pain in the ass, and I think I kind of was slow to start with this early stage section. But I don't know. I was just kind of. It just seemed very compelling, and I was intrigued enough to just keep going, I suppose.
Right. Because one of the main gameplay elements that's there from the very beginning is that as you are walking across the landscape, this road-free landscape, you have to balance yourself. And Sam carries a bunch of heavy shit on his back, stacks up on his back. And in order to balance yourself as you're walking, like as Sam takes steps, you have a shoulder button on the right of the controller, which will scan the landscape for you. And it will show you if something is green, if something is orange, or if something is red. And there's usually like a mixture as you're walking across rocks, walking up hills, going across shallow streams. And I think I actually did have a hard time at the beginning of this game. I was falling down a lot. You can steady yourself by holding down buttons that make Sam grip his shoulder straps and kind of walk more slowly and kind of hike. But if you're not doing that, he just runs. And I wasn't using the landscape scanner very much. I think you took to the gameplay, it sounds like a duck to water. And I took to it like a pig to water. I wasn't scanning the landscape. I was falling down all the time. I was like, wow, this is hard to even walk in this game.
Yeah.
And that was the tone that I got from the early game, was that this game is not going to make my life easy. Do you know what I mean?
I
feel like it didn't make my life easy. It doesn't make your life easy as a player.
I don't think it's supposed to. I don't think it wants to.
Right. This is actually something that I find quite interesting in the dialogue around Death Stranding, because the gameplay is kind of punishing, kind of laborious. You have to balance, you have to chart your routes. You're often dropping parcels and having to go and recover them. It feels like you're schlepping and that it's difficult. And one of the kind of the dialogues that surrounds this early gameplay is that Kojima wants to put you through your paces. He wants to push through the pain barrier. And so I was kind of intrigued by that as an idea. It's fair enough. And I was looking into what Hideo Kojima actually thinks about this stuff, whether that was his intention. And I found an interview with him in which it was a really cool documentary that was made just before the game released. I think it was by... No, it's not Noclip. I can't remember. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. But someone went to visit the Kojima studio, and his main concern pre-launch was that he wanted people to enjoy the game and that he wasn't sure if they would. So I think this is an open question about whether in his mind this was fun gameplay or whether he was actually trying to put you through some kind of pain barrier in order to make you feel a sense of achievement later on.
Mm.
And I mean, you do feel a sense of achievement when you get better at traversal and when things come along that make traversal easier for you. But I'm of the opinion that this introduction could have been a little more gentle. It seems like your character's kind of stats in terms of staying on his feet have been reduced immensely to make you tumble a lot in the early game. And some of the stuff you get later on that makes it a little easier could have been given to you from the off, in my opinion.
I mean, I think this thing, it links into the wider political point that I think this game is trying to make. But I'm not sure if I can go too into that without getting into some mid-game spoilers, really. You know, I think this stage of the game is basically trying to show to players how hard existence is when you are isolated and you don't have infrastructure and you don't have the support of other people. And you have to just live in this very egoistic, sort of individualistic way. And that's kind of where I saw that sitting with the story, because I think at the start of the game, Sam is someone who, you know, he can't have physical contact with other people.
That's true. He doesn't like to be touched or to touch others, does he? He flinches throughout the whole game when anyone comes near him.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting quirk of his character.
He's very, like, almost agoraphobic guy who just, and he just doesn't want to live in a city. He doesn't want to be around people. He doesn't want to help America, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously the game is very much about his journey from being a sort of, you know, it's this whole kind of no man is an island thing, like how he goes from being this person who is this self-sufficient, supposedly, person who doesn't rely on anyone else to being someone who's fully reliant on everyone else and people are reliant on him, and how he actually becomes a warmer human over that. And I think this difficulty curve is a way of that sort of element of the story manifesting itself in the gameplay, in a way. Because, yeah.
I think that's a really nice reading of the game, actually. It's not something... Sam's personal journey wasn't something that I kind of warmed to immensely, but one of the things that I like the most about Death Stranding, and I do like this game, I'm going to spend some time kicking the shit out of this game in this podcast, but I'm not going to be overly critical. I like the game. It's just that comes with a lot of baggage in this specific instance. Liking Death Stranding comes with baggage. But... in that early game, you are introduced to the landscape of this contemporary America, which has been eroded by timefall, and that is rain that speeds up time. So when it rains, plants die, the earth is eroded. If it falls on human skin, people get older, the rain damages things, it damages vehicles. And so it's kind of a hostile world that you're walking out into, but the way that this has been rendered is part of the kind of the crazy package of elements that is Death Stranding. You know, you have your Norman Reedus and you have your weird Amazon job and you have your kind of Icelandic landscape. It looks exactly like Iceland. It is a lovingly created, perfectly rendered Iceland hiking simulator. And this was interesting to me. Another big question about Death Stranding to me is, did Kojima sit down and make a plan for this game? Was it like, okay, so the time fall comes down, that ages the landscape, and therefore it's going to look gnarly like Iceland? Or, and I think the second one is true, did he think, I would love to make a game that's like Iceland, and then how can I justify it? And I would love to include this kind of architecture that I saw there, like the geothermal power stations that you see in Iceland look a little bit like the bunkers that you travel to in Death Stranding. And then he wanted to make a Hollywood movie, so he has Norman Reedus, he has Mads Mikkelsen, and all of these great actors. And I feel like these different elements are kind of almost crudely pushed together to make a structure that is quite kind of teetering and gnarly and knobbly, if you know what I mean. It feels to me like these elements don't quite sit like a jigsaw. It's more like 10 pieces from different jigsaws that have been kind of forced into a strange line.
Yeah.
So the fact that it looked like Iceland, I mean, I've argued about this with Death Stranding fans on Twitter. And there was one guy who said, if you read all the logs, everything will be explained to you, man. You just have to go deep enough and you'll understand it all. And he said, like, Timefall makes the land look like Iceland. And I was like, you know that Iceland is the youngest country, island in the world. It's volcanic. If you wanted to make an old landscape, you'd go to old countries. You'd go to the Rocky Mountains.
I thought
Iceland
it was,
is lava.
It was more because, because making it kind of geologically active and the idea that because when the timefall falls and like you see the plants like they're born, they grow and then they die like instantaneously. And I think this idea of this sort of constantly changing, you know, how do you age rocks, I guess, is kind of the, but yeah, I'm not sure how, like, yeah, I think you're right. I'm not sure how much he really, it's probably like a convenient overlap, but it also seems like...
Right. There's a lot of expediency in these plot details, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, I've just gone
but
on...
Nevertheless.
I'm on Wikipedia, right? You go on the Death Stranding plot summary, and there is literally...
you have to.
There's literally a warning, like, left by another Wikipedia editor under plot saying, this article's plot summary may be too long or excessively detailed. Please help improve it by removing unnecessary details. And it's like... It's like 2,000 words long, and I think that's pretty
right.
That's how much it takes to explain everything in this game. And I don't know if that's that means it's successful storytelling, really.
Right, because the idea of the detail being in the logs, I would say halfway through the game, without really reading much, without reading many logs. But there was a point in the game where I thought, okay, I think I was wanting to play Death Stranding, but a little fatigued of the core gameplay, but I wanted to stay with the game. It's compelling in that way. And so I just read them all like a book. I read 90 emails that I had received from people. Cause as you're running across the landscape, you're getting messages. If you deliver a pizza to someone, that person will then message you as you're running across the landscape to your next delivery point. And you'll see a little notification appear on the screen like you're looking at your phone, and you can either read it or ignore it. And I'm guessing that most players probably don't read that because they are busy running and they're engaged in what they're doing. But when I actually sat down and read them all, it was some quite nice writing, some kind of clunky, expositional over-explaining. It's almost like the logs exist as a way of trying to make these disparate elements fit together more clearly. And there was a lot of good stuff in there. But yeah, we've gone deep into the weeds here. As I guess we're going to a lot, because Death Stranding is a hard game to explain. It's a hard game to play. It's a hard game to understand. And it is a little bit of a hard game to talk about concisely.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I guess the easiest way of discussing it is probably... I guess structurally, which is that you have, this first section that's very like foot based. You're like a, what's the word? You're a rubber tramp in the kind of American term of hitchhikers. You know, you're walking along on your feet, and it's rough and it's hard, and yeah, you're kind of tasked with a bigger thing than just delivering things by foot, which is rebuilding the chiral network, which is what is like a 3D print. How would you describe it? It's like a 3D printer internet, right?
It's like Internet Plus. So people can share their research, they can share their schematics, they can share their scientific work, but they can also share 3D printing plans, and then according to whatever resources they have, physical resources, which you can move between these encampments, you can manifest details. So for example, if you visit someone that is a maker of boots, and he has made some special hiking boots, those hiking boots schematics are then uploaded to the Chiral network, and people across the network can make those boots on 3D printers themselves, right? So it's like a... I mean, I guess the internet is plausibly just... It's pretty much basically the internet. I don't think you can move matter through the Chiral network in the way that they're using it.
Yeah.
But you can... They share plans, basically. It's a fractured civilization. Everyone has been trying to make life a little bit better for themselves. And so as you bring these kind of nomadic, kind of reclusive survivalists onto the network, they just share their findings and their little life hacks with each other. And those things become available to Sam to make his journey easier.
I mean, yeah, a lot of these, I guess in the story, isn't it? They're trying to rebuild America. We need to make America alive again. And the way they're doing that is by... It's almost like this land has become like a wild frontier, and you have these survivalists who don't want to be part of this new state after the collapse of the US like government, I guess. And and so the way they're trying to rebuild America is basically the delivery company. I guess it's the equivalent of Amazon, isn't it? Bridges.
In Castaway, when Tom Hanks is that delivery guy and he's kind of sending an alarm clock that he then receives and opens and the alarm goes off. What is it? Which company is it again?
I don't know.
It's just like Hermes or something, you know?
Yeah. I guess the thing is it, in many ways, it's a game that is a story about a postman who becomes a broadband technician as well. Because Sam just wants to walk around and deliver post, but he's given this greater task, which is to connect people to this network. And I think this network is the most important part of the game, because it not only drives the story as he like travels from the East Coast to the West Coast, but it also taps into Kojima's main, I guess, sort of political or social philosophical point, which is this idea of connection, which he ties into the multiplayer feature. It's this feature of PS4, which I think they introduced when PS4 first came out, and they have it in Destiny and things like this. It's like half single player, half multiplayer, where you're not going into a server and there's like 60 people. It's like you'll be playing your single player game and then other people appear, or other people's creations appear. Like Journey did it, right? When you play Journey, you've got like, you'll see other travelers on the journey. And I think this was the first game, Death Stranding, that actually tried to be really ambitious with this feature and be like, okay, how can we make this integral to the gameplay? And I guess kind of as you're building this network in the story, you're also building it with other players, which I think is when the game starts getting very interesting to me, this side of it.
Right, because I mean, even in the early game, you can build ladders, which you can then drop across a river. You can build a bridge, but you can't build an entire bridge. You can build one end of a bridge, and that will usually use up all of your resources. But the thinking is that the next player who runs along in your instance of the game, because there are a few people that are in each instance, every time you load up the game, you are matched with a couple of other people that are playing at the same time. You never see them, but you can see the marks they've made on the landscape, the structures that they've built, and they can see yours. So when someone else comes along a little bit behind you, they might see your ladder across the river. You've saved them some time. You've made their life a little easier. They'll use your ladder. They can drop a like on your ladder, which you'll then see in your instance of the game. They can see that someone has built the foundation of a bridge. They can cross the river. They can set up the other side of the bridge. And then between the two people, the bridge has been created. And then the third person that comes along can use the ladder and then use the bridge. And so there is this kind of ambient cooperation going on, right?
And it's all my, and this is a very interesting thing for me, because I think the whole point that he's trying to make in this game is how you can use technology for things that aren't just, I guess, individualistic, or, you know, aren't just kind of consumerist, I suppose, because it's almost like this, there's like this internal gift economy in the game of like, right, well, I'm going to contribute according to my ability, like whatever I can, to the infrastructure of this in-game world without knowing if I'm going to get anything back for it. But because it's going to mutually benefit me and the other porters, or like other players, who are also going to do the same thing, it's a very interesting look at, I guess, almost like a model for a different economy in a way, because, you know, when you're building a, like later in the game when you can build a road, it's not something, it takes ages, and you're going to have to, you could never build it on your own. It might take you and 30 other players. But collectively, he's created this system, this infrastructure and this network, which incentivizes sort of this selfless cooperation. And I think it's when you move from being this very like isolated figure trekking with your backpack, and you start working with other players who you're never going to meet and you don't know who they are, but you're going to sort of, I don't know, yeah, mutual aid, I guess, is the term. You're offering this mutual aid to them. That's kind of the biggest, most important point of the game for me was this whole, how did he manifest a different way of thinking about a society, and how did they offer like a technological infrastructure for doing it that wasn't just like policies or ideas. It was like, okay, this is sort of this like socialist thing in action in a way. How can we get players to think in a way that's very fundamentally different to the way we usually think in games?
Mm-hmm. Right. And before we move on to spoilers, actually, I would just like to talk about how this game looks and how it feels to play. Because something that I noticed right off the bat is that when you first leave that first encampment with your first parcel, you're kind of running out into the wilderness. There isn't really, there's no trail to follow. There's maybe like a sheep trail on the ground, like a faint trail. And the way that the landscape is rendered, with weather that kind of sweeps across the landscape and these kind of towering, beautiful mountains, and the kind of the mossy ground and the gnarly rocks, the way that the water looks, it feels like, you know, and this game I first played in the time of COVID, when COVID was first becoming a thing. And I was feeling very, very, very stuck in the house and very far from nature and a little claustrophobic in life. And I guess that relates to the themes that you're talking about disconnection in society and urban living and all that kind of stuff. But striding out into that landscape as Sam, despite the fact that it was slippery and difficult and I fell down a lot, like, it was kind of beautiful. It did bring that kind of spine-tingling sensation of setting out on a hike into the wilderness and not knowing exactly what you're going to see, being surrounded by nature. And Death Stranding does give you that experience. I've got a sort of a pet theory that Kojima came to Iceland and had the kind of transcendental Iceland experience that you and I have both had. I mean, I live here now because I love it so much, and you've been here and had a fondness for the country. And I get the feeling that Kojima was like, how can I bring that experience to the world? You know, when you come to Iceland, you fall in love with the place, the raw nature and the power and scale of nature here compared to the smallness of cities and dwellings becomes very apparent. And I think Death Stranding actually does a wonderful job of bringing that kind of experience of nature into a game form.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And I mean, that kind of Kojima Iceland experience theory also goes as far as, like, I mean, I remember my first road trip around Iceland, we were listening to Ólafur Arnalds and Johan Johansson and all of this beautiful Icelandic music. And I think getting an Icelandic CD and putting it in the car stereo as you drive around, whether it's Sigur Rós or whether it's whoever, is a big part of it. And everyone does that. It's like part of the journey. And for Kojima, that CD was quite clearly
Low Roar. Yeah, he obviously picked up Low Roar.
He picked up Lóðr, and that was his personal Icelandic soundtrack in my working theory.
Yeah.
And so as you were walking around this landscape, as you perhaps crest a particularly difficult hill and you see the landscape rolling out before you towards your destination, a Lóðr track will start playing. And they always feel like, at least in the early game, I think it was a little overused. Like by the end of it, it was like, oh, here it is again. But for those first few hours, like every time a Lóðr track started, it was very beautiful. The way that the music was kind of used in this poignant way, at poignant moments in the game.
Mm. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, my one thing I wish there had been was the option to play the music whenever you wanted. Because sometimes I was having a nice walk and I was like, oh, I'd actually be up for some Lóðr right now. But then it just seems to play at random times.
I don't think they're random. I think they are. It always felt to me like they were moments when you got a view, or moments where you felt a sense of accomplishment, or moments in the journey where you'd kind of broken the back of the hard part of the journey. Mm. And it was like your reward. It was like, now you can relax, just run down the valley, listen to Lóðr, you know?
Yeah, true.
But I know what you mean. I mean, I actually wished that, you know, all these emails that you get,
Yeah. You're
pelted with emails as you're taking your journey. And you're walking a lot. You know, you can be walking for 20 minutes, half an hour on a single delivery. And I did wish that, I mean, if I was doing that, I'd be listening to podcasts, I'd be listening to music.
Yeah.
And I did wish that perhaps you could listen to your emails, you know, hear people reading them out as audio. Or have Siri read them out to you or something. So you could absorb all of this kind of world detail as you were running across the world. I think it would have made good use of the time, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's an interesting... Like, imagine there had been podcasts in this game, and I think it would have given you... Like, because obviously you have these cities, like destinations, and it'll be like population 60,000, but you never get to go into the city. You don't know how the people live there. But obviously there's a lot of people there, presumably. And, you know, I think it would...
Yeah.
Would have been kind of cool if they'd given you a little window into how the people were living rather than you just being in this sort of frontier. But I guess that was kind of the point anyway.
Right, yeah. Some of the people that you meet, like even some of the main characters that you meet in the game, this kind of very, very eccentric cast of characters, they do share their personal feelings and their personal histories with you in their emails. Some of those emails do feel like a cry for communication, you know. Mm. It's like someone that you've just met will tell you their difficult backstory because Sam is the person that's reconnecting them to the world. And it could have been really nice to listen to that as an audio log for the kind of the sharing of it, of the experience of living in this world. It would fit with the communication and connection theme. But anyway, that's not a feature. I actually Googled it to see if anyone had done an audiobook of all of the Death Stranding email content that I could listen to, because I didn't want to sit and read a book.
Yeah.
But it's not something that's in the game, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think Lóðr was fine. I think there just could have been more.
Right, and I guess we're headed towards our spoiler break now. We've covered that first section, so hopefully if you haven't played the game, we haven't given too much away. But before we move on to spoilers, for anyone that is leaving us now, I was wondering if we could do like a little... maybe we can just say if you would like to follow Kieran and find out where to find him online and follow him on Twitter and stuff, where can people find you online, Kieran?
So I don't have much of a... I don't have much of a personal, like, public presence on social media.
What kind of millennial are you, Kieran?
I have like a private Instagram and everything, but I run the Radical Art Review Twitter. So if you go on at Rad Art Review on Twitter, basically all of those tweets are me, and I'll be tweeting magazine stuff, but I'll be tweeting sort of random things as well. I run a cooking Instagram called kitchen_hazard, which you can see me make food. Uh-huh.
And you're an occasional Twitch streamer, right?
I am an occasional Twitch streamer, so I haven't done it lately because I think I need a better setup, so I've taken a break from it. But yeah, Face Cuddle on Twitch. I also have a gaming Twitter, Face Cuddle, that I really just use to share screenshots, and I think you tag me in sometimes.
I do.
but I should probably do that more. Yeah, Face Cuddle.
Follow Face Cuddle, follow the Rad Art Review. And is there anything that you would like to say to someone that is thinking about playing Death Stranding? What would you say to them?
I would say persevere past the first 20 hours and you might get rewarded. I just say you're
okay, and so that's it for the
patience first... pays off.
So that's our first section, and we're going to move on now to talking about spoiler stuff right after this. Music.
Cool.
Okay, we're back for the... Oh,
carry on. Go for it. I was just chatting shit.
You can chat. What do you want to say?
I was just going to talk about... I was like, if you go on YouTube and you search Death Stranding cutscenes, like... You know, people do these like mega cuts of cutscenes, and it'll be like GTA 5, the movie, and it'll just be all of the cutscenes. If you do that for Death Stranding, there is 12 hours of cutscenes in this game.
It didn't feel like it. You know, you'd kind of set me up for this kind of like epic, long movie length cutscene at the end, and I was kind of getting ready to just make popcorn and stuff, but it was kind of, it wasn't that bad. It didn't feel that bad to me. But anyway, we should talk about this in the thing. Okay, we're back for the second part now. From here on in, it's spoilers. First of all, just a little bit of gameplay stuff, and then we'll move on to talking about the characters, the plot, the craziness of this game. We didn't even mention BB so far. That's nuts. But yeah, so, I mean, the gameplay things that happen after that first section... I think when you finish chapter 2 and you move on to chapter 3, which is the chapter called Fragile, when Sam gets onto a boat and he sails across the lake from Port Knot City to Lake Knot City, and that's when the game really kicks into gear. You get introduced to combat, you get introduced to hematic grenades. In this game, Sam has special qualities that mean his blood can be put weaponized to defeat these ghosts, which we also didn't mention in the first part of the game, called BTs. The landscape is dotted with BTs. They're these lost souls that float above the landscape. And if you get close to them, they stamp towards you with these kind of handprints that splash up mud, and then they turn into a giant monster for some reason, which you then have to either escape from or fight. And yeah, you start off with hematic grenades, you end up getting assault rifles, you end up getting rocket launchers, you end up getting all kinds of crazy army shit, basically, a huge arsenal of gear to take these things down. But in that early part of the game, they are absolutely menacing, and they will kill you and reset you. And that too was very challenging in the early part of the game for me, because I'm not great at stealth gameplay. I know that you played Skyrim and Assassin's Creed, basically... full stealth, right? So you're used to stealth gameplay. I normally go in all guns blazing, and so creeping around BTs didn't come naturally to me.
I think, weirdly, I didn't actually play stealth at all in Death Stranding. I think I would just run. Like, I would just run through a field of these BTs, and they'd start stamping towards me, and then they'd pull me down, I'd drop all my shit, and then I would just run in a... I'd run to the... Like, they kind of appear in a pool. I'd run to the edge of the pool, then like slap them down, and then run back in and grab my bags, and then keep running. So I would just, because the thing is, I think I missed, maybe I wasn't paying attention, but you get given your first weapon, which is basically a rope, the strand thing, right?
Right, which I barely used.
I didn't even realize what it was until about, 60% of the way through. So I just had this whole mech.
Same, when you're forced to use it. Yeah, you're forced to use it at some point. And you're like, what the fuck? This rope actually does something?
How do you even summarize the plot to this game? I mean, I guess civilization has fallen, time happens too quickly, and they're trying to... Sam is like a sort of... do they say he's like... He's kind of adopted or something early on, and like by the president of America who dies.
Right. He's the adoptive son of the US president, Bridget, who dies at the start of the game. And Sam is called in by the acting kind of prime minister to, first of all, dispose of her body. Because when someone dies in this game, Death Stranding, they have what is called a void out, where the body starts to decompose and then explodes like a nuclear bomb. So death in this game is like a serious kind of threat to civilization. Like if someone dies in their sleep, then they can destroy a city if they're not properly disposed of. And Sam being the delivery man, the man who delivers, the Tom Hanks in Castaway, he has to then go and pick up Bridget's body and take her to a crematorium. So this is the very macabre introduction to that plot element, and also to Sam's kind of fucked up family situation.
Yeah, and for some reason, so a lot of the plot in this game is trying to, like, basically they're trying to work out what the fuck this event was, the Death Stranding, like a couple of hundred, was it 100 years ago or however long ago it is before the start of the game. Because they didn't actually, and there's, you know, they've kind mm-hmm. of over the years sort of picked apart how it happened. And I guess at the start, you know, you kind of explained that, like, you know, there's this place, the beach, which is kind of, I guess, limbo or purgatory between, like, the realm of the living yep. and the dead. So when yep. someone, you know, basically the dead things go there and what happened is somehow this beach, the dead things from this, like, this beach of the dead, which also happens to look exactly like Reynisfjara in South Iceland, sort of erupted back into the world somehow and wiped everything out. And, you know, that's why you have the BTs, which are like the beach things. Sam has BB, which is a little unborn baby in this, like, and your own, and his best friend. It's like Norman Reedus and a tiny baby in a jar that he
Norman Reedus and his funky fetus.
And the idea is these kind of, I mean, they don't treat them like babies. They're just known as this, like, they're like a connection between the real world, the human world, and the beach. And they're able to sense things from the beach, and you help, this baby helps you, the BB helps you sense the BTs and the enemies so you can avoid them. And what I think, well, this is one of the favorite parts of the plot, really, is the journey with Sam and the BB, because it's mm-hmm. supposed to be a tool. It's supposed to be this, like, object you don't treat as a living, sentient being. But obviously, he starts calling he names the baby. He names BB Lou. And I think they had a lot mm-hmm. of tender moment. The first kind of tender moments in this game is when, you know, when, like, if Sam gets tired and he takes a sit down, he kind of just, like, cradles BB and just, like, he's like, come on, Lou, like, it's okay. And, like, you have to, like, shake this baby to, like, calm it down on this walk. And, mm-hmm. And yeah, it's kind of an interesting. I mean, again, like, I don't know how, there's so many things in this that are just different strands that you could just go down a wormhole talking about, you know, so.
I know. I listened to what you said, and it's like perfectly coherent way to talk about the game, but there is so much in this game that any path that you walk down ends up sounding crazy. It's like the whole thing about the beach, the whole thing about exploding corpses, about this psychic fetus in a jar that you carry with you, the time fall, the apocalypse, and the prime minister who wears a skull mask for some reason, and then this kind of terrorist cell that wears gold masks that are related to the pharaohs in some way, the mythology of death and the pharaohs, the symbolism of beached whales on this black beach where Sam sometimes finds himself as someone that can travel between realms. There is so much in this game that it's absolutely overwhelming, first of all, to understand, but definitely to talk about. And I think that that's where this game crosses over into art movie territory. It gives me a similar feeling to David Lynch movies, to something like, what was that one that has the rabbits in it? Midnight something. God, it's gone out of my head.
Remember.
But those Lynch movies, Lost Highway, movies like that, like where David Lynch throws at you disparate plot elements, disparate characters, symbolism, strange scenes, and it becomes a jumble in your mind that somehow forms a kind of an atmosphere. And I think sometimes I let go of the steering wheel on a story or a game, and I stop trying to understand it, and I start just treating it as an atmosphere. And that works for me. Like when I played Kentucky Route Zero, it's another game that has vast amounts of references, symbolism in the storyline, and lots of different characters, lots of different issues being addressed. And at some point, I decided to stop trying to understand it and to start trying to feel it, if you know what I mean. And I think that's the only way that I could kind of reconcile myself with Death Stranding. I don't feel like, even if I scrutinized every email and blog entry that the game gives to you, that I could form a coherent understanding of this story. I'm not entirely sure that it is coherent. I think that it's perhaps an assemblage of atmospheric elements and elements that are of personal interest to the director. And that results in a deeply eccentric and very confusing, like, melee of different shit. And so I decided in the end just to kind of feel Death Stranding, to take the atmosphere, to take the things that I liked and leave the things that I didn't, if you know what I mean.
I mean, I liked the... I think the problem with it is that, firstly, I think he wanted to make a movie, but he doesn't know how to make movies. And I think this could have really benefited from, like, I reckon bringing in, like, a separate... I mean, I don't know who they had on staff, but sure, I think they could have done with bringing in, like, a TV director or something, or someone who could just polish this a little bit and, you know, decide what's the important stuff that you really need to explain. And then, because I felt like what they happened in the plot of this game is they introduce all this crazy stuff and then they explain it to, like, the nth degree. Like, everything has to be, and I'm like, I actually would have preferred it if there was a lot that wasn't explained and it was just sort of this crazy background that I could have drawn inferences from myself. But it gets to the stage where everything's explained. I mean, I love some of these details, you know, like my favorite thing is the Timefall Porter, which is like the beer that you unlock that you can start drinking. And they're like, oh, it's a porter beer, which porter beer was invented in like the 17th century by like porters in Britain who were doing the same job as Sam was hundreds of years ago. And we're able to brew this beer in like 3 days or something because the Timefall makes the crops grow quicker or ferment faster. Mm. We use Timefall instead of water. And I'm like, that's genius. I was like, you've really like thought of how to apply this idea to like a tiny little thing. Like, that's cool. But I think what happened was, and especially as you get to the horror, which I'm sure we'll get to, the horrible long end game, which ruined the game for me in many ways, I think. It's just, I think there's... I don't think they needed to explain everything. I think we could have... It would have been better to have just this atmospheric kind of... Just like, okay, yeah, cool, there's monster energy. Like, why? I don't know. Like, let's just stick it in there. Like, I think that would have been great.
Right. It does almost seem like with Kojima in the kind of auteur director role... It was like any idea that he had made the cut. There was no editing. Any idea that, so one day he's like, hey, Sam Porter Bridges, Porter's a drink. Let's put in Porter the drink. Okay, how do we make it fit? And then like results in an A4 page of an email that you're supposed to read. And it's like every little kind of eccentric quirk that occurred to him. It's almost like after being edited, apparently feeling edited in his last job at Konami, and suddenly being given license to do what he wanted, he took that and like ran naked screaming through the fields as a director, you know, and didn't edit himself at all. And what you get is the kind of explosion of suddenly being empowered to enact every idea that occurs to him. And so you could say that that's creative confidence. You could say that that's like a pent up directorial energy that's just exploding into this game. But I mean, I've watched some documentaries about how games are written and how games are made, and I think especially in for example Horizon Zero Dawn, like the team had kind of put together a rough outline of what the game was going to be, but then when they brought in a professional writer who kind of basically hacked away half of their story and said, no, that doesn't fit, we're going to have to do it like this, and then they had to change gameplay elements because of that, and that cross-play between the design sensibility of making a game and the writerly sensibility of editing a game into a coherent form, made Horizon Zero Dawn, which is quite concise, quite crisp, quite well put together and coherent and understandable in a traditional story sense, even though there are complex elements of sci-fi in it. Death Stranding did never have that writer presence. And so it's an unedited tidal wave of enthusiastic ideas from a very eccentric mind that doesn't result in a coherent game.
I mean, I feel like it's like, you know how like Apocalypse Now took like 5 years to edit? I feel like if you've ever seen Heart of Darkness, the documentary about how they made Apocalypse Now, which is like Francis Ford Coppola just took like everyone into the jungle in the Philippines and basically everyone went a bit mental and like Martin Sheen had a heart attack and everyone was on acid and they were set up like supply lines through the jungle of steak and it was just all this crazy shit. But then they spent like three to five years editing it, and then they spent another 30 years getting to the final cut. I'm like, I think Death Stranding is like like jungle acid madness, like bit of Apocalypse Now. And I reckon if they had a good like 10-20 years of editing it, they might polish it down into something that makes sense. And I know they're releasing a director's cut soon, right, which is weird to me because
that scares me.
Because like, what, this wasn't the director's cut? Like, what's exactly the director's cut?
Right, I said that on Twitter and someone actually said to me that they felt that Kojima had been given money by Sony on the condition that he could deliver this game by a certain time, and that perhaps the reason that some of these elements are confused seeming and the editing process seems to have not taken place at all. It's not that it's badly edited, it's that it's unedited. And they think that perhaps he was working to deadline and that the director's cut might trim some of the fat and tighten up some of the looseness. So that's one theory that Death Stranding fans have, is that Kojima was
I mean,
rushed.
They're doing it for PS5, and I think it will look really good on a PS5 at the very least. So,
right. According to your schedule, by the time we're on like PS9, maybe Death Stranding will be coherent.
I mean, I think the thing with this game, like the story's crazy. There's loads of stuff that doesn't make sense, but there's just this, and I think you probably hit, it was probably the same stage for you. You know, I think it's when you start building, once you start really kitting out the chiral network and you start kind of conquering the landscape with roads and zip wires and vehicles and bikes and trucks, and you get into a swing of it. I think this sort of section of maybe 20, 25 hours, I think was an incredible experience that was so just, I don't know, liberating and refreshing and just fun compared to the rest of they almost kind of drowned out many of the sort of problematic elements of the rest of the game for me, because it really just sort of came together. And you know what we were saying earlier about the early game being quite difficult and challenging, and I think a lot of that is a setup for this section later on when you start winning and it's not a slog anymore. And
right.
And it feels really, it's a really cool, special thing, I think.
Right. I'm with you on that. I think some of the high points of this game were really, really high points. There is, I think a turning point for me in this game was getting supportive robot legs that Sam can kind of strap on, these kind of robot prosthetics that he wears that steady him. And so he can more easily clamber up things. He doesn't lose his balance. You can actually forget about pulling your left strap and pulling your right strap and like schlepping. And you can start actually just running and kind of taking it in. And I kind of wish that had been there from the start. And as you get through the game, you get access to vehicles, obviously. I mean, by the time you could get trucks, the game changed completely. The zip lines, which when you told me about zip lines, I was feeling skeptical. I thought it's going to be like a little bit like those climbing ropes where you have to like put in one end and put in the other and slide down a little rope. But it turns out that's not what they are at all. They're like these huge catapults that kind of flip up out of the land when you come near one. And Sam is cradled and he's kind of catapulted across to the next zip line. And because of that kind of player interplay that we talked about earlier, I was often using a Zipline network, which I had contributed to, but half of it was by other people. And you can see who placed each zipline. So as you're walking up the mountain, you're thinking, okay, what's a good point where I can put one, not just to get back down, but to create a junction that will connect to this other part of the zipline network. You know, if there's a zipline network that leads up to the mountaineer, if I put a zipline here, then it will actually let me go to the doctor or back to the city. And those moments of kind of flying over the landscape and creating that missing infrastructure collaboratively, that felt like freedom. And the early section of the game feels like weight. And I do wish that, like, when they had set Sam out at the beginning, that he had had those stabilizing legs so he could just walk. Like, it's just a little too tough at the start, a little too slow. And it would be very easy to just give you a little more power at the start to help you through that first section and to make it a little less of a frustrating experience at the start.
Making that section shorter. You know, I think you could have I could have happily done, like, 4 or 5 hours with no kit. And it'd been hard, but I think it's because it's like 20 hours before you start getting all this stuff, and it just seems to come in a little bit late. But I mean, yeah, I think when I start, I have one of the most memorable bits of the game was, you know, I'd got to the mountain, which is kind of the last big section of the game, and
it's a wonderful. Yeah. It's the main section, I think. It's like the main course of this game.
I built the road all the way through the valley, all the way up to the mountain, but. Obviously, what you're left with then is like, okay, the road for the mountain, you've got to kind of go like, you know, north and then round. And it takes a long time if you're doing drops. So I was like, oh, I need to, when I first got to the mountain, I was like, I'm going to build this zipline network over the mountain into the valley. And what happened was I was almost like at this stage of the game, it was like each drop and each journey would only be hard once. I would just do like one schlep.
Yeah.
Bring loads of kit with me and just lay down bits of infrastructure along the way, and then I could just zoom back really easily. And I remember it was when I was trying to extend the zip wire network over the peak of the mountain back down into the valley where the weather station with the big satellite dish. And
absolutely beautiful.
My flatmate Jan at the time was watching me, and he'd never really watched the game before, and he just watched me do this like epic hike into the mountain where like there's areas where you know there's no chiral network coverage, and I'd have to like drop zip wires onto the edge of the network and then walk across an expanse of nothing and then plop one on this side where there was. And I think I got really high up on the mountain, my equipment started breaking, everything started rotting, I lost my shoes because the snow is frozen time for, it's like a lot, it ages things even quicker or something. And it was like the closest I'd actually come to just dying on a hike. And I think I was on like a tiny amount of health. I ran out of blood, and just like, Jan's just watching me just kind of drag Sam's body. Like, and at one point he had to lie down in the snow, and it was just awful. And then we got, kind of kept going through the snow, couldn't really see, and then all of a sudden we're walking down this snow drift, dropped a zip wire, and the snow turns from like white snow to the first patch of grass, and I saw it, and Jan was just like, oh my god, like he was just like, I have shivers, like it was just this beautiful moment where it's like like literally seconds from death, and I like staggered, he like Sam just staggers onto this grass patch, just like catches his breath, and then manages to complete the zip wire network down to the weather station. And then he just got like, took him to the shelter the private room to recover. And he just drinks this thing and then just zoomed back up the mountain in like 30 seconds after that. And it was just this epic little kind of self-made story that didn't have anything to do with a mission, but it was one of my most memorable moments of the game was the mountain zip wire hike.
Yeah, absolutely loved that part of it. There was something very satisfying about so this is the part where I agree with you. After having the difficulty of traversing on foot and schlepping, like the freedom and the kind of feeling of victory that you have when you use zip wires and you're flying over BT infested areas.
Yeah.
They can't get you. You're kind of flying like a bird over this difficult land, and you know how hard it is to cross that land the first time. And so the fact that you're not doing it is like a feeling of victory every time. Every time I used the Zipline network, yeah, I felt like I was winning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I want to, I guess, kind of to contrast, my favorite bit of the game is like the shit I the stuff I hated so much, which...
Right. Okay. Get into it.
I think
we haven't talked about Cliff yet. We haven't talked about the fact there is a World War II fucking SAS SWAT team gauntlet that you have to jump into the past and become a kind of a Marine with a machine gun taking down army ghosts in a kind of a hostile battlefield, which just completely tonally is just disharmony. It's tonal disharmony.
So Sam is carrying BB, and for some reason, random parts of the game, he gets these like almost dreams or visions of like a view from a baby, and Mads Mikkelsen is this guy Clifford Unger who is chatting to the BB as if it's, you know, you kind of ascertain that like it's the baby's father. And then for some reason, Guillermo del Toro's, you know, character, Dead Man, isn't it? He's called. He's like, yeah. Oh, Sam.
Because he's made out of different people's body parts, yeah, like, apparently.
Again, I'm not going to question it too much. And he's like, oh, Sam, there's a storm. So everything's problematic and you've got to go and fix the storm. And you go to this storm and basically a tornado comes along and just slurps Sam up and spits him out in World War One to start with. And at this point in the game, I hadn't used any guns at this point. Because even though the guns had been introduced, I just hadn't got into combat at all. I was just chilling. So I didn't really know how to use the shooting system. And you've got, basically, you're like fighting Mads Mikkelsen in a trench. And he's been like, I want my baby back. Like, BBB, where are you?
Yeah, trench warfare. Suddenly you're in Call of Duty
against Mads
Mikkelsen.
Yeah, and I found it extremely difficult. And I think that was the first time I really rage quit. And I didn't play for about 2 weeks because I was just like, what the fuck is this? Like, what have you? Why am I here? And these sections happen 2 or 3 times. And I think they get better, but... You know, I think the story element of who Cliff is and who BB is, is a really, I think, a really touching story, and I really liked it. I think it was one of the more emotional elements of the game, but I don't know why they decided to like buttress that with the war.
Right. If you edited out all of the war sequences in Death Stranding, it would be a better game.
Clifford's story would be fantastic. I guess there's the whole thing there about how this is another example of Kojima just shoehorning something in. And I think he put these in as a sort of anti-war narrative to try and fit in with his wider thing. Because, you know, it's all about how kind of Cliff spends all these years fighting, but actually at the end it's about building bridges, you know, like this this kind of, but I think they just didn't need to put that in. I think you could have just not had the war thing, not had any of that. You could have had this simple story element, which is like these flashbacks to this father who is losing his wife and you don't know where it comes from and it's explained later on. And I just don't know, that just didn't need to be in a war. I think like it could have just been been anything.
Yeah. I agree. I think that the main atmosphere of the game and the part that everyone enjoys or at least talks about the most is hiking. It's like hiking across a landscape, and that's what the game is really at its best. And the fact that you sometimes have to do these boss battles, a little bit boring, but it feels like Kojima is a video game guy. You know, he comes from that kind of that Metal Gear background. He plays games. And it feels a little bit like the video gamey elements. They're even flagged at some point. I think like Troy Baker's character Higgs at one point says one more boss battle as part of his dialogue. And then there's this ridiculous punch out right at the end where you just have to punch him to death. And it's a shout out to Metal Gear, and it's a kind of a nod to, I guess, Kojima's existing audience. Like Metal Gear fans who want to go into mule camps and stealth people, or who want to face a big monster. You just kind of drop that shit in there. And maybe that's just his taste in games. Like, he wants that to be a part of the game. But I felt that those two elements of the game were kind of pulling in different centers of gravity. I feel like the real heart of the game is this kind of pacifist dystopia where you're just hiking around and you're trying to piece things back together. That's the main game. And the fact that there's a war element, the fact that weapons are introduced, the fact that you have to machine gun people and take out these bandit camps, it's a tonal disharmony. And I honestly wish that he'd had the kind of the directorial confidence to rid himself of those ghosts of Metal Gear and to kind of just make a game that is about running across Iceland and delivering parcels and reconnecting the world, and forget World War II and forget like stealthing bandit camps and facing off against giant monsters. Yes, that's video game stuff and fine, it's in there. But I feel like it could have been a better game had it been like wholeheartedly lopped off some of that video game baggage.
I mean, I quite like the bandit camps. But apart from that, yeah, I agree.
But I mean, some of the boss battles were memorable. I mean, Higgs is a great antagonist who's kind of wasted. It's like he's this specter who treads behind you and follows you on your journey, like your terrorist nemesis. And then it ends up that like 2/3 of the way through, you just have to have a shitty boss fight with him where you have to Google how to beat him because it's fucking nonsense. And then Higgs is dead. And then Higgs is dead. He's gone. And suddenly it turns out the bad guy is your sister. We're in the spoiler zone, so we can say it. Who is a kind of a supernatural beach entity whose job is to destroy the world. Okay, Hideo.
I mean, yeah, the whole ending, supremely alienating, and it actually made me angry at the game and made me want to just, like, it made me dislike the game. I loved the game till the ending, and that just, like, 6-hour, like why are you introducing exposition at, like, in the last 90 minutes of the game? Like, it doesn't make any, like, it just... I was just sitting there and I just like would finish a section of this massive mega ending and I'd just be like, please, please let this be the end. And then, you know, there's that bit where you're on the beach and you just have to walk around the beach for like 45 minutes.
Oh God.
And then the like, worst. There's a credit sequence. Why? And I'm like, yes, finally the game's over. And then there's like another 3 hours and then there's another credit sequence. And I just saw it let me go. It almost felt like they made two alternative endings. One of them being that Sam gets trapped on the beach forever, and the other being that everything good goes well. But it just seems like, and this is an interesting point a few other people have made, in the story, like, the problem with the story in this game is nothing Sam does really influences or impacts the story of the game. It's almost like, no. And it's like, you can do anything, you can go anywhere, but you're just going to have to plug in and sit there. And there's no sense of, like, you having an impact on the outcome of this world. Even though, like, the whole story is about how you are carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders, but nothing you do actually changes the fate of it as a player. And
yeah, it's true. You're being told this story.
And it seems like, you know, this example of these two endings with two credit sequences, it seems like this is something where if they'd had an element of like choices matter in the story, you know, you get the good ending and the bad ending. Like some games do that, right? That's like that's a thing and it's done pretty well sometimes. But I think because, yeah, you didn't have any influence over the story events, like, yeah, this ending just didn't make, I just wasn't invested in it in the same way as I would have been. I think because I just felt like I'm just a delivery guy who watches cutscenes.
Right. I feel the same. I think that the good part of this game is the traversal, and the reconnection stuff, the building stuff, the road, the zip lines, infrastructure building, vehicles. Gameplay, in a way, once you get past that painful, and in my opinion, like slightly ill-conceived difficult early section. When you're in the meat of the game, which starts at Lake Knot City and runs through until you're over the mountain, yeah, basically, that's Death Stranding to me. And like the 20 hours that come before and the 6 hours that come after that are just a lot of story nonsense that you just have to kind of deal with. But I mean, in the end, where did you come down on this one? If you kind of look back on your experience of it, what's your kind of critical take away from this one?
I mean, what, the story or the whole game?
The game. Like, if you were reviewing this one, what would be your final paragraph and what would you score it?
I think, I mean, I don't know if I can put this in like a succinct way, but, you know, Death Stranding is an incredible non-linear game that is horribly hampered by a very linear story that is quite self-indulgent. And I think they could have quite radically reformulated the story in a non-linear way, in a way that would match the gameplay. You know, for example, like, I think a big problem with it is you've got these amazing actors, you've got this motion capping, so they're like, okay, we're going to do this scene, we're going to give Mads Mikkelsen 200-page script. I know it probably would have been harder, but I would have liked it if, in the course of you traversing and the course of you doing deliveries, instead of having like random cutscenes where all the characters show up, you know, why couldn't it have been, we deliver something to Mads Mikkelsen, who then joins you along for part of the ride, or you do, you know, I think this game is basically incredibly ambitious, but it's tried to do too much. And some of the stuff it's tried to do is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But that incredible stuff is sometimes horribly damaged by all the other stuff that is not quite as well executed. And I think really this Kojima needs an editor. And that...
Oh my God. He needs an editor so badly.
So I loved this game and I think it's a big mess. It's a big, lovely, beautiful mess that is not really anything like anything anyone's done before. And for that, it is commendable. But it's also deeply flawed and alienating in many ways. So that is my critical analysis.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel the same. I think my takeaway from it is that there were some incredible high points. And I am glad that I played it. But there were also some really, really like rancid low points where I just hated the game. Every time I started a combat section, I was basically just going to grit my teeth, run through it as quickly as possible, get to the end, breathe a sigh of relief, and then back to Death Stranding. Great. And so there are these kind of interruptions of war and plot exposition. So you just have to sit and watch 20 minutes of some guy rambling, or you have to go into a war zone, and then you can get back to Death Stranding. You get back to the fun part of running around. And so I agree with you. I think there's some sort of dizzying highs and some just shockingly ill-conceived lows. And to enjoy this game, you just have to be willing to embrace them both. I think in the end, as a complete package, the fact that it has such highs and lows means that it's it seems strange to say for such a dizzying construction, but it's a bit of an average game. Like for such a non-standard, innovative, groundbreaking game, I end up thinking that I'd like to give it like a 6 or a 7 out of 10 because the highs are so high, the lows are so low. So as an overall score, I'm not willing to kind of entirely buy into it. Do you know what I mean? I have to say this is a good, ambitious game with many deep flaws. And that's just the way it is with Death Stranding.
Yeah. I think I'll give it 9 out of 10 just for being bold, even if not successfully. So
okay, good. I like it. I like that critical stance.
I think clearly, look, he left Konami. He stole a bunch, like half their staff to go and found a new company from nothing, make a completely crazy new game that was prided itself on the fact that conventional developers would never touch it with a barge pole because they thought it was going to be a commercial flop, and just created something absolutely mental that is completely epic and just chaotic. And as an artistic endeavor, I completely respect that.
Yeah, that's great. I think you're right. I think that these are two totally different and totally valid ways of looking at it. I also applaud the boldness and the unconstrained creativity. And like David Lynch films, you know, no one sits and rewatches them, and like they're an experience that you have, that you take something away from and move on. They're intentionally messy and open-ended, and Death Stranding does get to that point. So if you're comparing a video game to a serious cinematic cornerstone of like of art cinema, like David Lynch movies, then something has gone right. And I mean, David Lynch movies are frustrating too. You know, the plots are messy. There's just a lot of symbolism, a lot of weirdness in there. And so it's definitely, I would say, elevated. It's an elevated game. But I think that as an artist then, I think Hideo Kojima has a lot of work to do and has arrived at a place where he has like Hollywood-sized budgets without necessarily having gone through the kind of the artistic refinement that people often have on that journey, if you know what I mean, because of the trajectory he's taken through games industry. He's arrived at the position of auteur, having perhaps not been through some formative experiences that could make his output better. And I hope that he has the kind of the confidence to learn from the reception that this game got and to kind of refine his vision in his future stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I think victim of success.
Victim of success, exactly. Well, I think we've kind of covered it. I really enjoyed that conversation about it. It's a fun game to talk about. It's a mess, and it's really nice to untangle it with you. I feel like you could talk about this game forever, but we're in an hour and 16 minutes here. It's a bit of an epic conversation.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for the talk.
That's all right, John. Thanks for having me on again.
So thanks very much to Kieran Daly for coming on. If you'd like to follow Kieran online, you can find him on Twitter at Rad Art Review. That's the Radical Art Review magazine website. You can also find it at radicalartreview.org. And Kieran is on Twitch as FaceCuddle and has a seldom used gamer Twitter account, which is also at FaceCuddle. So I encourage you to go and find him on Twitter and to at him and try and get him to tweet about games more. Always fun to talk to Kieran. And thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that one. You can find me online as Gaming in the Wild on Twitter, Twitch, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Twitter is the main place where I talk about games every day. I'll be back next week with another episode, hopefully talking about some Returnal, talking about some Ratchet and Clank, talking about some Carrion, and who knows what else I will have played by then. If you would like to support this podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. Thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other. Bye bye for now.